Are you looking for adventure? Do you want to find peace? Long-distance trails offer you freedom and discovery. They offer a way to connect to yourself and to the world around you at the same time. The most popular trails have become crowded, but there are so many other trails that have plenty of space. The Trails Around the World podcast is here to introduce you to new trails and to new types of trails and to expand your horizons. Join me as we explore finding out what is possible and how to do it. Christine Turmer, welcome back to the Trails Around the World podcast. This is your fourth interview you've done with us, which makes you our most frequent guest. And I'm very grateful to you for coming back again. And today we are hoping, we're planning to talk about two trails on islands. I approached you about doing interviews about, I approached you about Crete first, but you suggested that we also discuss Canary Islands. But we're coming into winter now in the Northern Hemisphere, and the winter is a challenging time for long-distance hiking. So you've overcome that on a couple of occasions by hiking in places that are warm enough to hike in. Crete and the Canary Islands are both in Europe, but the same principle would apply many places in the world, Asia, North America, etc. I think many of my listeners will be very familiar with you already, as are many people who are not my listeners. However, why don't you briefly introduce yourself for those who might not have heard of you before?
Okay, my name is Christine Turmer. You're getting close, but you're only close. So Turmer, T-H-U-E-R-M-E-R. So as you might recognize from the accent, I'm from Germany. My trail name is therefore German tourist. And I'm sort of a professional hiker, which means I stopped working a normal office job, and I've been hiking ever since 2007. And since 2007, I have covered 60,000 kilometers on foot on hiking trails. And I've hiked the Triple Crown. I've hiked three times all over Europe. I've hiked in Chile. I've hiked in Australia. I've hiked New Zealand. Basically, give me a name of a trail. I most probably have hiked it. So, but today is very special. We hike, we talk about relatively short trails. And because the last 2 years have been very special for me as well. And this has to do, of course, with Corona. Because before Corona, my hiking season started somewhere in March or April. I started at point A, somewhere in Europe or somewhere in the US. And I walked continuously in one straight line to point B, where I ended usually somewhere in October or November. So I did really long through hikes. As I said, I've hiked from northernmost point to southernmost point in Europe, Europe east, west, and so far and so forth. So usually it's one continuous long through hike. And by the way, I've written three books about all this. I'm also a best-selling author and a speaker, such as by the way. So, but after Corona, this didn't work out anymore. Because all of a sudden, like all sorts of countries would go in and out of lockdown all the time. So I couldn't really plan. I remember in 2020, I wanted to do a long through hike from Germany to Finland. But all of a sudden, this country closed down, this opened up, another country opened. So it was, you couldn't really plan a long continuous through hike anymore. So I started doing I looked at my bucket list, said, oh, there's this trail. So usually I would have connected these trails. But all of a sudden I said, okay, so I just go there and do this trail and then go back and see what countries open now and so on and so forth. So, and also in order to do this, because I'm also very budget minded, I needed destinations that are easily and relatively cheaply accessible. I mean, it doesn't make sense to fly, for example, from Germany to New Zealand just to do a four week trip. It's neither eco-friendly nor is it like budget friendly. So I was looking for something that is a relatively that is in Europe and that is a popular tourist destination, because if it's a tourist destination, it's easily accessible and very budget-friendly accessible, because there's all the cheap flights for tourists there. So this is how Crete and the Canary Islands popped up. They are very, very classic tourist destinations in Europe. So there's a whole load of cheap flights all year round and lots of flights. So this is how the idea came up. And both are so far south that they are sort of doable year round. And I just say sort of, because I think we start with Crete. And Crete is actually, if you want to through hike the trail in Crete, it's not doable year round. It has a very short season if you want to do the whole trail. But we talk about this soon, I think.
So yeah, and you're touching on why I wanted to do this. Many people, perhaps their job keeps them busy in the summer, and since I'm sure there's a lot of overlap with people who are involved in the outdoor industry, of course, the outdoor industry is often busiest in the summer. So then how do you get your long distance hike for the year in? And this is one of the ways.
Exactly. So it is also like both trails are, at least for my standards, relatively short. You can do them in 3 to 4 weeks. Usually I do longer trails, but they are doable. And this is another bonus, because they are on very touristy destinations. They are also beach destinations. So it's the perfect occasion to combine a hiking holiday with a beach holiday.
So let's go ahead and examine each of the trails in some more detail.
So again, we have two trails. We have the E4 on Crete, and we have the GR131 on Canary Islands. And right. I think we start with Crete, right?
We might as yeah. I mean, we have to pick one. So, well, first of all, broad overview for the sake of comparison. How would you compare the two? In broad strokes, is one more lush than the other? Does one have higher mountains? Is one more green?
Okay. The biggest difference is that Canary Islands are extremely popular tourist destination, and hiking tourism has been a big pull factor on Canary Islands for decades now. So that translates into hiking trails. The GR131 on Canary Islands is extremely well maintained. So it's a very, very, very easy trail, despite the terrain being sometimes steep and sometimes difficult, but it's easily doable even for beginners. Whereas the E4 on Crete has been created like as part of the European long distance trail E4. And the E4 actually runs all the way from Tarifa in southern Spain all the way to Cyprus. So mm-hmm. It's one of the longest long distance trails in Europe. And the section on Crete is just part of it. So right. It's not maintained at all. And it's very, very badly marked. And we'll deal with it in more detail later. But it's not a beginner's trail.
Okay. And you were just saying Crete is not a beginner's trail. How would you characterize the terrain and the scenery on the E4 in Crete?
Okay, let's start with Crete. Crete is, of course, a Greek island.
Yes.
There is two well-used airports there. It's Heraklion and Chania. So this is where you fly to. Very easy. You fly when you do the trail. You basically fly to Heraklion, and when you leave from Chania. So the island itself is relatively small. It's 250 kilometers long and 60 kilometers wide.
So about 150 miles by 40 miles.
Exactly. But considering that it's such a small island, it has three mountain ranges that are surprisingly high. All these three mountain ranges I'm going to mention now are more than 2,000 meters high. I said it's about
7,000 feet.
Yeah. 7,000 feet, yeah. So relatively high mountains. So we have the Dikti Mountains, the Ida Mountains, and the White Mountains, which in Greek are called Lefka Ori. So, and this makes the trail relatively difficult because you're constantly going from sea level up to 2,000 meters and more. Mm. So it's really, really your legs have lots of work to do. So, but the problem with the, let's start with the terrain. So all these mountain ranges, especially the Lefka Ori are extremely spectacular. If you look at pictures, you think you're on Mars or you're on the moon. It's completely white. They're called white mountains for a reason. It's mm-hmm. all white, basically sand and rock.
Right, not snow.
Not snow. The problem is that if it rains, which it rarely does, the water just disappears. So, uh-huh. So there's nothing growing there in the White Mountains, absolutely nothing. And the only water is from cisterns. So water is a big, big issue on Crete. It's not so much an issue in lower elevations because Crete lives basically on two things, or you have the impression that it lives on two things, which is like tourism. It's incredibly touristy, so there's hotels all along the coast. Uh-huh. And the other source of income is actually olive oil, olives. So you'll be hiking through olives all the time, and these olives have to be watered. So my symbol for Crete is actually these black plastic tubes that bring water from the water sources to back to the olive orchard, to the olive orchards. Can you say olive orchard? Or is it olive garden or olive?
I'm not sure. I think, they're trees. In any case,
trees, exactly.
Let's call it an orchard, and I'm not certain how one refers to it.
So the olive orchards are actually watered very well. You just have to find a way how to access the water in the tubes. So, but once you're out of the olive plantations or whatever, then you have a water problem. So this makes the E4 a bit tricky. What is also relatively tricky on the E4 is that I think the idea for the E4 stems back from the 70s or 80s or whenever. So back then they made some effort to mark the trail. So once mm-hmm. in a while you see metal markers, but you usually see them there where the trail is easily accessible by car. And this is where you need the markers the least.
Right.
But once you access the high mountains, then the markers disappear because it was so difficult to mark. And the other problem is that this idea of the E4 stems back for decades, and nobody has sort of maintained or developed the trail any further. So there's long stretches where nobody really knows where the trail is. Mm-hmm. So there's a guidebook, or there's actually several guidebooks for the E4. So the authors of all these guidebooks think, hey, there isn't an official trail anyway, or nobody knows where it is. So we just look ourselves, what is the best route?
Right.
But what has been a very nice route back when the author like explored the trail maybe like 5 or 6 years ago, today might be totally inaccessible. So this means like every author makes up his own sort of like detours, routes or whatever, and you never know whether you can actually pass through or not pass through. And the big problem there is that beside having olive orchards on Crete, there's a lot of goats and sheep as well. So these, of course, they have to be fenced in somehow. And normally, the fences are in most countries of the world, these fences are made out of barbed wire or mm-hmm. whatever. And here in Crete, we have a specialty because they make the fences out of, you know, these metal things that you use for concrete buildings to enforce concrete. You put in these metal structure.
Rebar,
exactly. Rebar. That's the word. So all
steel,
the...
They use steel rebar?
Yeah. They use steel bars, steel rebars to create fences for kilometers. So the problem is you cannot bend rebars. You just cannot bend them. And you cannot also crawl underneath them.
Right.
And it's very dangerous to climb over them. So the only, so let's say this one author has discovered, oh, this is a great route you can take. Why don't you go there? And you have the GPX track, you follow it, and all of a sudden you're facing a rebar fence and you have no way of crossing it.
Right.
If the builder, the only way to cross it, if the landowner, he has to access his meadows anyway, but he creates doors. So he has like pieces of rebar and he fixes them with wire or with rope or whatever. And then you can open the door or close it. But if there is no door left, there's hardly any way to cross a rebar fence. So actually, I still have a scar from hiking on Crete because I tried to climb over one of the rebar fences, very rusty ones. And of course, I didn't quite make it. So now I have a big scar on one of my calves. Luckily, I was vaccinated, so I didn't get any infection. But still, this is something you really have to deal with. Fence climbing is not possible, so you always need a door. And especially, I have never, ever seen any other country in the world where they have rebar fences.
There's lots of livestock, right?
There's lots of livestock. And of course, the good news with the rebar fences is, because there are fences, there is no dog problem.
Okay.
Because in other parts of Greece, of course, in order to protect the livestock, they use dogs, of course, cattle dogs, sheep dogs, or whatever.
That is where I was headed, yeah.
Exactly. So because of all the rebar fences, you don't need them. The only time where you will encounter dogs, and this is really, really very, very sad to see, if, let's say, there's a meadow and there's a heavily trafficked road going through the meadow. Heavily trafficked means like maybe a car every half hour or so in the mountains. So then they leave the rebar fence open.
Right.
In order to protect them, they have a dog on a chain.
Right.
And the only protection the dog has is a steel drum. So the landowner comes maybe once every three or four days, brings some food, brings some water, and the poor dog is there on a chain in this metal drum for days left alone. It's really very, very sad to see. These dogs are in a very bad shape. And they are so afraid of humans. So if you come to these crossings, that, as I said, the rebar fence will be open. There will be a dog. Its chain will be just long enough to cover the whole whole gap in the fence.
Right.
So cars can pass through, hikers can pass through. And don't be afraid. These dogs are so ill-treated. They are afraid of humans. And if you come, they will let you through. So this is the only time where you will really have a close encounter with dogs.
That's interesting. I've never heard of that before. So
you don't want to be a dog on Crete.
It doesn't sound like it, no. So this trail is quite high. It's largely around 2,000 meters, you said, right? Or even higher?
No, actually, the problem is it goes up and down all the time.
Right,
You start at the coast. Actually, this is, I wanted to thru-hike the whole thing. I wanted to hike the entire trail, which is around 500 kilometers.
Right.
Problem is, nobody knows where the official start is. So there is, depending on the guidebook, the start is at a place called Kohlakies or at a place called Sakros.
Uh-huh.
So I was there in off-season, and there was no bus going there anyway, so I just chose Kohlakies, which was the closest where I could get to with a taxi, and I started there. So you from Kohlakies, you go through a spectacular gorge, and we talk about gorges soon because gorges is one of the main highlights of this trail. So it goes through the first gorge, which is called Kohlakius Gorge, and you end up at this beautiful beach called Karumes. And this beach is only accessible by boat or by hiking trail. So mm-hmm. it's like this picture postcard beach and nobody there. And so you're at sea level. The problem is you somehow have to get away from this beach, and this is where all the trail markings disappear. And this is like where I was like lost for the first time. I had to, how do I climb out of here? How do I get out of here? With sheer cliffs, this Karumes beach is like bordered by sheer cliffs. And I had no idea how do I get out. I was already contemplating like swimming around the cliffs. When finally I could see some like really hidden trail blaze somewhere on the cliffs, and I found a way to climb up. So, and it's all the time like this. You climb one of the mountain ranges, you go back to sea level, you climb up again.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, so you also
sea
go
level
up
meaning that you go through a gorge at the bottom.
Exactly, usually gorge. And this is what makes this trail so spectacular. There is like literally like dozens of extremely spectacular gorges on Crete. The most famous one is called the Samaria Gorge. It's really world famous. I think it runs for about 15 kilometers. You run through this gorge. You actually have to pay. You have to pay a fee to go through there because it's so touristy. It's extremely spectacular. You have like sheer cliffs on both sides, and it's like one of the main tourist attractions on Crete.
Do you need a permit if you're hiking through on the E4? Do you need a permit? Do you need to pay or?
You just have to pay. You just have to pay the fee. But because there are so many alternates, as I said, like the E4. There's a theoretical route through Crete, but this was like conceived like many, many years ago. Nobody maintained it. And a lot of sections on this official route are on pavement. So all the guidebook authors, they created their own routes or own alternates. There are several alternates. So, for example, when you come to the Lefka Ori, to the White Mountains, you can either traverse the White Mountains, or you can go down to the beach, or you can traverse the mountains and then go down to the beach via two alternates. So you have so many options, and all these options go through really, really spectacular gorges. The only one you have to pay for is Samaria Gorge, which is very, very touristy. But there is other gorges as well where they're as spectacular and you don't have to pay anything.
Is there any comparison between this and, for instance, the Arizona Trail, which hits these altitudes and is dry, but I'm guessing it's very different.
It's very, very different because, like, let's say the highest point on the E4 and on Crete is Psiloritis, which is the highest mountains, 2,400-something meters.
Okay.
And from there, if you're on top, I was standing there on top. Actually, it was so cold. I was hiking there in June, and there was still snow left, old snow fields. Uh-huh. So up there, I was freezing. Actually, to get there, it was very windy. It was rainy. It was one rainy day on Crete, and I was, of course, climbing the highest mountain there. So actually, it was so cold. I was so freezing that I had to seek shelter in one of these old shepherd's huts called Mitata. They are made out of rocks. So the shepherds have like sort of like put one rock on top of the other, and you have like sort of igloo style shelter. They are so tiny, I actually had to crawl on all fours to get in. It was the only way to get out of the wind.
Huh.
So I'm standing finally on top of Psiloritis. On top there is a small rock chapel. So you ring the bell. There's a small bell attached there. So I was so happy I rang the bell, and you have an incredible view. And keep in mind, the whole island is just 60 kilometers wide. So from Psiloritis, you can see the coastline. So all the time you're on top of a high mountain, you can always, always see the coast. You can always see the water. And it's kind of like totally bizarre because you're up there and there's nobody there, not even sheep, no shepherd, no goats, no nothing. You are totally alone. You look down onto Heraklion or onto Chania, where there's literally thousands of tourists like partying or lying on the beach or going to discos, and you are up there in a total solitude. So this is a bit bizarre. And you're still, if you look down from Siloritis down to Heraklion, it's just like as a crow flies, it's maybe 20 kilometers or 25 kilometers, but you're in a totally different world. And that's totally different from like places like the Arizona Trail, where you're really in the middle of nowhere and there's no civilization close by. Mm-hmm. Whereas here, you're always close, but it's not, the civilization is not accessible. Plus, you always have this very good tourist infrastructure. So
in Crete.
So if it all gets too much, you just descend down to a beach. And this is so touristy. There's literally hundreds of hotels, of private rooms, or God knows what. So if it all gets too much, you just can hang out. And prices are really competitive because there's so many different places. And also, like, there's restaurants. The food is just incredible. I mean, this is an island, so seafood is like, wow. So you can always, like, pamper yourself and then head up into the mountains again.
Right.
So you have the infrastructure, but you can the tourist infrastructure, but you get away from it when you're once you're up in the mountains.
Right. So what you were just saying makes me think seasonally, were you there in the off season in terms of tourism, and what season is best to do this? You said that there are times of year when you just can't do this trail on this island.
Exactly. Okay. So if you want, of course, this Crete is very far south, but it's still not equator or anything. So it still has really, really very distinct seasons. So even in winter, there is no beach tourism. But because the mountains are so high, as I said, we're talking 2,000 meters plus, there's actually lots of snow in winter. So if you want to through hike it, you just have a very, very short window because it's either too hot or too much snow and too cold, because you're mm-hmm. constantly going from sea level up to high mountains. So for a through hike, you can either go May, June or September, October. This is the only time where you can do a through hike. Other than that, it will be either too hot on the beach or too much snow in the mountains.
Right.
So we are talking shoulder season. I mean, May, June is sort of shoulder season. This is not when everybody and their kitchen sink goes on summer holiday. But if you just say, okay, I don't want to go to the White Mountains, I don't want to do the high mountain stuff, I'm happy to do the beach stuff, then you can do it year round. And then actually winter would be very good because on the beaches, this is not like your relaxed beach hike. It's not like you walk on sandy beaches all the time. There is actually fabulous and world-famous beaches on Crete, like Kedradosos, which is like the hippie beach for decades. Mm-hmm. And Kedradosos, it's like, wow, you see the pictures. It's really like, wow. And everybody's camping in hammocks in the dunes, and really, really spectacular. So there is sandy beaches, but in order to access them, you really have to go through rocky cliffs. And they are so sharp-edged that one fall and you'll really, really hurt yourself badly.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, in summertime, it's so hot and there's no shade and there's no natural water sources that actually lots of tourists have died because they wanted to say, oh, we want to combine like a nice hike from the parking space to this and this beach. And it's just like 3 hours or 4 hours. So we just go, no problem. And they actually die of heat stroke. So this trail is not to be underestimated. And it's full of like, when you're roasting in the sun on the beach, you'll be freezing up on the mountaintop. So it's like the climate is very, very different.
Yeah, and one should emphasize, this is the largest Greek island. And of course, the Greek islands are almost mythical in being some of the most beautiful beaches in the world.
And mythical is also the right cue word now, because as I said, you can on Crete you can combine a hiking holiday, a very, very adventurous hiking holiday, with a relaxing beach holiday. But what you can also do, Crete is the cradle of the Greek culture. This is where the Minoan culture like blossomed. So you pass through an old temple site. And when you fly to Heraklion, you can visit like the National Museum there. You can do all sorts of like day trips to archaeological sites. It's so full of culture. It's amazing. So as I said, there's lots of things you can do and can combine the hiking trail on the E4 with.
And of course, the whole story of the Minotaur and such that hopefully everyone remembers from their childhood, reading about Greek mythology, that all occurs on Crete.
Exactly. But to finish Crete, what I would really want to emphasize is that this is not a trail for beginners.
Right.
Because there is two guidebooks, one in English by an Italian guy called Luca Gianotti. And if you buy the guidebook, you can also download his GPX tracks. But again, and also like all these sorts of alternates. But again, this is tricky. What Luca found to be like a very good trail back when he explored the trail might now be fenced off with rebars. Or they might have dug a trench, or there might have been a landslide, or God knows what. So it's not like you can easily plan. And plus, there is this one section in the White Mountains. And I was really doubtful whether I should do it or not. I was deliberating because there's alternates around it, but it sounded very spectacular. So actually, a German guy contacted me who had helped marking the trail like 2 years ago. And he gave me the exact GPX track. And he said, hey, why don't you try it? I help marking it. There is like marker poles, because this is like a really high mountain, rocky. So we had to mark it with these poles so you can see them from far away. So I had the exact GPX track, and I attempted it. I started doing it. And honestly, I don't feel ashamed to say it. I turned back, because it was too difficult.
Right.
We are talking like, I started going up there. I realized there's no water.
Right.
I couldn't see. You climbed really steeply up, and it's sheer, very slippery it's rock. And it's still so, the angle is still that you can just walk on it. But I looked at the soles of my shoes, all the grip was gone. And it was getting steeper and steeper and steeper. All the mountain goats were like, what is she doing here? And there was no cell phone reception in this area. And plus, this is another thing that I want to mention. There is very, very strong winds. It's called, can you say fall winds? Do you know what I mean?
There's a name for it on the beaches in France. And then there's the Scirocco in North Africa, right?
Catabatic winds.
Catabatic winds.
So that
sounds right. Catabatic winds.
And they are so unpredictable. So because they hit you, there is this one like, wow, this, it's like a blow. It really hurts you, and you can't predict it. Like it's totally calm, and then all of a sudden, like there's this, wow, this. The catabatic winds. So it's really dangerous, because if you try to keep your balance, and then all of a sudden you're hit by the wind, well, it makes it a lot more difficult, especially when you carry a heavy backpack. So this guy had given me the GPX track for a detour, which was extremely spectacular as well, but much safer. So what I want to say, it's really technical. There's really some parts of it, some sections that are really technically difficult. Mm-hmm. If you combine all these factors, if you combine lack of water, catabatic winds, unpredictable weather, no cell phone reception, no exact GPX track. So this is more or less like for more expert hikers.
Two other things. Where did you sleep? How did you deal with lodging and resupplying on food? And the other thing is water, and how did you make sure that you didn't run out of water and find water as you were hiking?
Okay. Lodging is actually very easy, because you're either staying in your tent. I don't think it's illegal in Crete, but nobody really cares, because there is no one in the mountains except some goats and sheep. So once you're away from the beaches, once you're like in the countryside or in the mountains, you can just pitch your tent almost everywhere. There's lots of sometimes you encounter stone wall terraces, like abandoned stone terraces, but you'll always find some place and nobody really cares. When you're close to civilization, it's very easy because there is all kinds of lodgings everywhere. This is an incredibly touristy destination. So you have from 4-star hotels to like really cheap pensions or private rooms, you have everything. So, and again, like after like a couple of days in the mountains, you'll be so exhausted, you will really look forward to staying in a nice hotel or in a pension or whatever.
Yeah,
and also like treat yourself to the food. I mean, the seafood is just incredible. It's like it's an island. So a mixed seafood grill is like the best you can have there. And so coming to water, water is a very, very difficult issue in the mountains. I just mentioned that because there is hardly any natural water sources, you have to rely on cisterns. And so if the cistern is locked, then you have a problem, because, for example, I remember in one of the mountain areas, there's a mountain hut there. I contacted the hut warden, and he said, "Hey, I'm not there. It's off season. I'm not in the hut. It's locked. The cistern is locked. I left 4 liters of water on the porch in plastic bottles. But if they are gone, well, there's no water. Then you have to descend the next village, which is another 3 or 4 hours." And luckily, back then, there were still 2 bottles of water left. And it was totally bizarre because I was staying at this mountain hut. Again, it was locked. I set up my tent there. And there were skis. There were skis above the entrance of the mountain hut. Because in winter, they do skiing there. But in summer, in June, when I was hiking there, it was so hot. There was no water and the cistern was locked. So difficult.
Huh. It seems like Crete would be, for someone with the skills to tackle it, a wonderful way of combining challenging hiking, overnight hiking, and interspersing that with enjoying many of the luxuries of life, like good food and resort standard lodging.
Exactly, exactly. It's an adventure trail where you can pamper yourself if you want to. So that's probably finishes up. And one last sentence for Crete. I hardly know any other region in Europe that has so much outdoor potential or potential for hiking trails, and but which is so little used. So there's so much potential,
yeah.
But it's not utilized. So yeah. Go as long as nobody is hiking there.
Yeah, well, and of course, that's one of the real objectives of my podcast is to find places, good alternatives, because so many places are becoming crowded. And this sounds, in terms of hiking, Crete is not crowded.
Depending, again, like if you go to Samaria Gorge, it's incredibly
right.
crowded.
Right.
But other than that, actually, I didn't meet any other through hiker on the trail. No, not a single one. Not a single one. I met lots of in the gorges. I didn't go to Samaria Gorge. It was closed back then because of Corona. But uh-huh. I went through other gorges that are sort of popular. I met dozens of day hikers there. But this is only day hikers.
Yep.
Then they go with their rental cars, do a hike, and then go back home.
Yep. Wow. Nobody else overnight hiking. All right. So before we finish with Crete, how long is the trail in both distance and time?
Okay. Crete is, as I said, nobody knows the official route. So it's about uh-huh. 500 kilometers.
Okay.
And usually I would hike 500 kilometers in something like 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks. But yeah. As I said, this is really, really difficult. So
right.
It's not, if you go up to the high mountains, it's not like your typical 20-mile day is not really doable. So I would at least calculate 3 weeks, preferably something like 4 weeks, because you want to hang out at the beach, you want to eat something. So if you really want to leisurely through hike the thing and enjoy Crete, I would calculate 4 weeks.
Okay. 500 kilometers is a little more than 300 miles. Are there any other considerations or safety and security concerns and that sort of thing that you would raise?
Nothing except the water issue, which is a problem. But yeah, and the difficult terrain. No, that's about it. As I said, dogs are not a problem.
Right. Variables in the cost for this trip. It sounds like you've already largely been through those. Airfare, how much lodging you use, how good the meals you have.
Exactly. So it actually, once you are there, and flights to Crete are relatively cheap, once you're there, you can live relatively cheaply because, like, you can stay most of the time, you can stay in your tent, you can buy food from the local supermarket, or you can eat out, which is, again, for European standards, relatively cheap. I mean, it's not a dirt right. cheap trail, because still it's touristy, it's tourist prices, but it's right. but it's a very economical, very affordable trail because of all the competition between the different accommodation places. You don't have to stay in a 4-star hotel. You will always find a more right. relaxed family pension or whatever.
So does being there in the off season help?
Yes, if you want to skip the high mountains, if you go in off season, there's lots of competition because the tourists right. are gone. Then it's even easier.
Okay, so you could pick the sections that are at lower altitudes and
exactly.
skip around between those. Are those also less challenging, less dangerous?
Yes, mostly. Yeah.
Not always. Yes.
Not okay. always. Not always. The rocks are always very sharp edged, no right. matter where you go.
Yeah. No, I've experienced them, so I understand. And you're not joking. They are simply sharp. So moving along now to the Canary Islands and the GR131, you said it's a popular hiking destination, so that explains how you would have known about it. Is there a history that you know of for the trail across the Canary Islands?
Actually, whole Spain has a GR system. GR is like Gran Recorrido. It's the mm-hmm. same like the Grand Randonnée in France. So there's yep. like long distance trails all over Spain. So it was natural for them to have this as well on Canary Islands. I have to add that there is one island where there is no official GR131 because they sort of like forgot about it or haven't developed it yet. Still, because it's so touristy, there is like hiking trails all over the islands. So there has been, there's always at least an unofficial GR131. So that's not the problem. So Canary Islands, why did I come up with it? It's hardly anyone through hikes it. And I will touch on why this is the case. It's but because there is so many tourists who go flock to the beaches, they want to do like section hikes or like one day trips to the island. So this is why they have a very, very good hiking network. So, and one thing to keep in mind when I hiked the GR131 is that I was very lucky or extremely unlucky, depending on how you look at it, because I booked the flight in February 21. And back then, nobody could predict what would happen on September 19th. I don't know whether you're familiar what happened on September 19th on the Canary Islands. Do you know?
No, go ahead.
On the island of La Palma, a volcano erupted. It was one of the biggest volcano eruptions for really centuries. And it was really amazing. The eruption, the authorities heard the rumbling, so they knew something's going to happen. So they evacuated the people. Like 6,000 islanders were evacuated mm-hmm. just in time because on September 19th at 3:12 p.m., the eruption, like, it was wow. The eruption was like the lava was spit 1,500 meters high into the air. It was just absolutely incredible. And with this came these toxic fumes.
Right, right.
And the hot glowing lava. So nobody knew what was going to happen. So I was going to hike this in October, and November. So I was like, okay, this is 19th of September. I checked statistics. And usually volcano eruptions just last something like 2 or 3 weeks. What I did not know back then, this was one of the longest volcano eruptions on the Canary Islands. It was going to last 3 months.
Wow.
So basically, the GR-131 was closed off on La Palma, on the island where this eruption took place.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it was very early on my hike. I started my hike on October 31st on Lanzarote, which is like the easternmost island. So I was still thinking, okay, this will take me 3 to 4 weeks. Oh, it will all be finished when I get to La Palma. I had already written off hiking on La Palma because the trail was destroyed. So mm-hmm. It was natural that they closed it off. But I said, okay, I can at least fly back from La Palma. What I didn't realize is that because of all, when the volcano eruption happens, you have these very, very, very fine sand. And this is very dangerous to plane turbines. So once the sand gets into these turbines, the plane crashes. So right. As long as there was a wind blowing on La Palma, they closed down all air traffic.
Right. Well, I remember that was a major issue when Iceland had the eruption as
exactly,
well.
Exactly.
And none of the planes could fly through there.
So the same thing happened on La Palma. And to spoil the whole thing, I finished the hike on La Palma. I was sitting in my hotel. My flight was like at the day before they closed off air traffic, and I was still hoping. I was sitting in my hotel, and 6 hours before takeoff, they canceled the flight.
Mm-hmm.
Because the wind was just blowing. They were just waiting for the wind, because if the wind was blowing in the right direction, it was blowing the sand onto the sea. So then the planes would take off and land. But I was so unlucky, like right the day when my flight was scheduled, it was blowing the wrong direction, they scheduled the flight. It all turned into a nightmare because I had to get back to Germany, I had to find a different flight, I had to take a ferry to another island, I had to pay an enormous sum of money to get on an alternate flight. It was all really a nightmare. But still, like I was there when this eruption took place, so... the tourists were lacking because the tourists didn't dare going to La Palma. Of course, like they didn't know if they could fly there or get away. So there was very few people on La Palma, only like TV journalists and their cameramen, because they were doing live reporting from the eruption right. scene.
Right.
So they had sort of like viewing points. And I went there at night. I went at night to one of the viewing points, and just to see red glowing lava, like flowing out of the volcano, and the red glowing lava was actually illuminating the night sky, and the night sky was like really blood red. It was absolutely amazing, one of the most spectacular sights I've ever seen. Yeah. So it was really worth it, despite like yeah. my hike was interrupted. And yeah. actually, this lava, this eruption, like enlarged La Palma. It's now several acres bigger than before, because the lava, once it flows into the sea, it gets cold and it creates new land. So La Palma now is much bigger, not much, but it's a bit bigger than it used to be before.
The Canary Islands are further south than Crete, I think. And Crete yes. is... In the Aegean Sea, it's the largest of the Greek islands. It's south of mainland Greece. So it's south of Greece and west of Turkey. Whereas the Canary Islands are off the coast of Africa, right?
Exactly.
They're down south of Spain. And Spain, of course, is thought of as being south in terms of Europe. And, of course, Africa being south of Europe... You head on down the coast there and off the coast of Morocco, or Western Sahara, actually, are the Canary Islands. But they're part of Spain.
Exactly, they're part of Spain, but they are so close to the equator that there is very little distinct seasons. So it's basically hikeable. The season is all year round.
Anytime. Mm-hmm.
So I said, I hiked the trail in November, and you could basically do it year round. I mean, with very few exceptions when you're very right. unlucky with the weather. But so tourist season is even in December. Actually, this is high season. Avoid December because this is when everybody from all over Europe goes to Canary Islands because it's still EU. It's still
right.
European Union. But it's as I said, it's African climate, so it's very warm. You can go year round. So again, because it's so touristy, the good news is that there is cheap flights or relatively cheap flights from all over Europe. Still, because it's so far away, it's if we fly from Germany, it's a 4-hour flight. I mean, don't get sort of like lured to the idea, oh, this is Europe, it's close. No, it's not close. It's pretty far away from Spain. As I said, it's like Africa. It's just off the African coast. So the distance from mainland Europe is pretty far.
Right.
Still, because there are so many tourists flying there, competition is high, like all sorts of like holiday carriers are going there. So you'll be able to score a cheap flight.
Plus, well, from the United States, one would want to fly to Spain and then down to the Canaries,
exactly,
right?
Yeah. Exactly. You could take a ferry, but this takes ages forever because really the distance is tremendous.
Yeah.
So again, like on Crete, this is popular tourist destination, which means there is hotels all over the place. It's but if you go there at the wrong time, they are probably all fully booked. I mean, I was surprised at some places. It was really difficult to find a room because I was there in November, which is like gray and dreary in Europe. So again, it was already high season on Canary Islands, and popular places, it's even difficult to find a cheap room in November because everything's booked. So let's start with one caveat, with one thing that you have to keep in mind when you hike that, which makes it... which made Canary Islands, for me, one of the most expensive trails in my career. And this is something I didn't really evaluate before, so this is why I really want to warn you. So you can fly relatively cheaply to the island, but in order to through-hike the whole thing, you have to get from one island to the other.
Right.
So I stupidly had thought, okay, this is like the inter-island ferries. There must be lots of competition and people have to move from one island to the other, so they will be cheap. And this was totally wrong. The system works like that. You can either fly or take the ferry. It's about the same price, but you're much more flexible, of course, with the ferry. So if you're a local, if you live on Canary Islands, the ferries are really dirt cheap because the locals just pay 1/4 of the price for 1/4 of the tourist price. But mm-hmm. if you're a tourist, you're basically subsidizing the ferry fares for the locals.
It's so, the same as the trains in Switzerland.
Exactly. Sort of, yeah. So if you want to through hike it alone, you have to pay alone for the ferries 300 euros. 300 euros, all ferry rides, combined. To make things worse, of course, there is several ferries per day going from one island to the other. But these ferries cater for tourists with cars. So usually you have a very early morning ferry or a late night ferry. If you want to save money like me, and you want to camp and then take a ferry during the day, go to the next island and go from the ferry port to the next campsite, this is hardly ever possible.
Huh.
So you not only have to pay for the ferry ride, you usually have to pay for one night's accommodation in the port town, because the schedule is so unfavorable for hikers.
Right.
So and I was there like in November, which is almost high season. So you pay something like 60, 70 euro for a cheap accommodation plus the ferry ride. So each ferry ride sort of like ended up paying something like 100 euro.
Uh huh.
So, and you also lose a lot of time with the damn ferry rides because, as I said, they don't cater for the hiker schedule, it's for car tourists. So
right.
each ferry crossing, you basically lose one day and it's six islands. So almost like 1 week is lost for transfers.
Mm-hmm.
So the GR131 is all total. If you go through all six islands, is something like 560 kilometers, which you could easily do normally in 2 to 3 weeks. Right. But because of all the ferry rides and all these things around, you will need at least 1 month.
Right. So 350 miles.
Something like that, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, in that vicinity. So we're talking about the logistical problems and, of course, the dramatic experience of the eruption. But what were the trails like?
My conclusion was one of the most expensive hiking trails in my entire hiking career, but worth every cent, really worth every cent. The landscape is nothing short of spectacular. It's wow, wow, wow. Because like Canary Islands, it's, as you see from the volcano eruption, is all volcano origin.
Right.
And you can still see that. Plus, it's six islands, and each island has a different character. So the scenery is always, always spectacular, but is always very different. Like if you go from, which I would recommend, if you go from east to west, you start at Lanzarote, which is pure, pure, pure volcanic, and it's the volcano ash there is pitch black. So it's really a black island. Contrasted by white villages. Traditionally, villages, all the houses in Greek villages are painted white.
Right.
So you have like a pitch black landscape with these white dots in it, uh-huh. and sometimes green dots, which is cactus. Actually, there's lots of like cactus fruits. You can pick your own, mm-hmm. you know, cactus fruit. So bring gloves or bring tweezers or bring something to you can eat the cactus fruit. They are really abundant, really abundant. Uh-huh. So this is you really have to like this sort of landscape because hardly anything grows there, which is not irrigated. But from a landscape point of view, it's really, really dramatic. But it is very, very difficult to stealth camp there because there's nothing to hide behind. There's no hardly any growth or anything. So what I did, and this is another thing due to all the tourists, the bus connections on public transport is excellent on all three trails, on all six islands. So what you can do is like the islands are not usually very big. So you find yourself a home base and you take the bus, hike a day, go back to your home base, take the bus again. And buses are cheap. Bus rides are very, very cheap. So if you're afraid of stealth camping there, which is really very, very difficult, just base yourself somewhere and do day trips. Another thing that makes stealth camping difficult, at least on the first two islands, is the wind. Again, we are just off the African coast.
Right.
And the wind is blowing constantly every day. Really, wow. Really strong wind. So very difficult to pitch a tent without any shelter. So if you move from Lanzarote to the next island, which is Fuerteventura, same sort of landscape. Very volcanic, hardly any vegetation except irrigated like vineyards or something like that. But at least they have built shelters for the hikers, wind shelters. You're not supposed to sleep there, but nobody will stop you if you do. So this makes things a bit easier on this island.
It sounds like, again, one could make this into a very nice mixture of the fabulous hiking with the luxury and just give in to the fact that it's going to cost something. And as you were saying, stay in a base camp type situation and you can, because the public transportation is so good, you can section hike the long distance trails.
Exactly. So when we're moving now to, so this is the first two islands, which is like Lanzarote and Fuerteventura. They are very windy, very volcanic, very barren. So then things change when you come to Gran Canaria, next island. Gran Canaria, there is no official GR-131. Oh, sorry, I've forgotten about it, or I don't know why, or I don't know what, but no problem because all guidebooks describe the same alternate route. So basically, there is a GR-131, it's not marked as that. So, and on Gran Canaria, for the first time, you go up, or let's say, how do I start on Gran Canaria? The trail there starts in the tourist place of Maspalomas. And Maspalomas is really like one of the worst touristy spots ever. Like people do binge drinking there. You have discotheques, like all the bars have German and British names. It's really, it's one of the most horrible places you can imagine of mass tourism. So this is where I arrived, again, very late in the day because of all the ferry connections, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh God, this is a nightmare. How am I going to camp here? So I hurried out of the city. And I went to the first canyon where the trail is supposed to go up into the mountains. And as soon as I was in this canyon, the only thing I could hear was the owls, the birds. And it was nothing. I was just 1 hour walk away from the discos and the bars of Maspalomas, which like people were really partying hard there. And all of a sudden, like just one hour walk away, I was in this canyon. I could as well have been like in Arizona, because you feel so remote, so far away from all the tourists. So from there, you finally go up into the mountains, and all of a sudden, like it becomes very forested. There's lots of like forest fires there, so the trees there have adapted. They are very fire resistant.
Right.
And Gran Canary is like, this is another thing that most people don't know. The Canary Islands were actually sort of like colonialized by the Spanish people back in the Middle Ages. Before, there was really like an indigenous population, which is now all completely extinct. But these indigenous people, the Canaries, they had their religious cults. And in the holy mountains of the Canary Islands, they are now UNESCO World Heritage. You can still visit some of the caves where these indigenous people worship their gods. So, and once you go stand in front of these caves and look down on this volcanic landscape, you easily understand why they worship their gods there. It's truly, truly spectacular. So, but the scenery there on Gran Canaria is completely different. It's more or less like what you will find in the deserts in Arizona, like on higher altitudes, the same type of trees, same type of scenery, all but a bit more spectacular because it's all volcanic.
Right. Sounds very dramatic.
it is very dramatic. It is very dramatic. Yeah. And then you move on to the next island, Tenerife. And Tenerife, what people also don't realize is Tenerife is home of the highest mountain in Spain, which is the Teide. And it's because everybody thinks, oh, the highest mountain in Spain might be Pyrenees. No, it's actually on Tenerife. And the Teide is a volcano, and it is 3,715 meters high. 3,715 meters, highest mountain in Spain.
3,700. That's higher than Mount Fuji.
It's again, it's also a volcano.
So, and I'm going to dump that into a translator and give the feet because that's approaching Mount Whitney, I think.
So the trail does not go up Mount Teide. And actually very, very few people climb the Teide. It's a very difficult process because if you climb during the day, you have to have a permit. So most people climb at night and have to be gone by 9 o'clock because then there's a lift running up to the Teide, very, of course, relatively expensive. So most people don't climb it. They take the lift, look around and they go down by lift. So you could do a trip, like a side trip to the Teide, because like the trail, the GR131 passes by the information center. So you could do a day trip. I didn't do it. But still, the trail climbs up to 2,400 meters of elevation on Tenerife. And there in November, temperatures really go down to freezing at night. So before, you're sweating all the time because, again, you're so close to the Sahara. It's you're, as I said, you're close to the African coast. But because of the altitude, it can get pretty cold. So bring really do bring warm clothes if you want to camp there.
Just to give the feet on that, so 3,750 is 12,300 feet. And Mount Whitney, which is the high, I brought that up, but Mount Whitney is the highest mountain in the lower 48 of the United States. You went over it, of course, when you were doing the Pacific Crest Trail. And that is 14,500 feet or 4,421 meters. So Whitney's a little bit taller, but Fuji's 3,400 something. So it's between Fuji and Whitney in height, which is enormous.
Yep, it is enormous. So, yes, so you pass by, you can do a side trip, but even like, because the trail there passes through a huge caldera. The caldera is several kilometers wide, and Teide is just in the middle of this caldera. So, but the whole landscape there is just wow, wow, wow. It's like you're like, oh my God, all the time. It's absolutely amazing, really absolutely amazing. So this is Tenerife, and again, like as soon as you're high up, you either have barren lava because it's too close to the actual volcano.
The volcano,
Or you have these Arizona type forest situation with trees.
Right.
And the vegetation completely changes again on the next island, La Gomera. La Gomera is very, very small. You can cross it in 2 days. But La Gomera has something, a very specific type of tree that is, again, UNESCO World Heritage, which is called Laura Silva Forest, Lauri Silva, which means the trees are all covered with some sort of moss. And the idea is that this moss is sort of like catching the humidity in the air, which is then dripping down to the ground. And this is how these trees get their water from, because it hardly ever rains.
Right.
But you have the humidity from the clouds. So the Lauri Silva Forest actually is like water catcher. So it looks like sort of a fairy tale forest because there's something dangling from the trees all the time. It's all really sort of very lush and green, despite that the whole island is very barren. So very, very unique, very, very unique scenery there as well. And then we move to the last island. Again, then there is another island, El Hierro, which is tiny, tiny, tiny. You can almost cross it in 1.5 days. I skipped it because it would have cost me like over 100 euro to take the ferry and ferry back again, because there is you can just do it as a day trip from Tenerife.
Right. And it was tiny.
It's tiny, and it's very expensive. Again, you have to, all the hassle with the ferries. But El Hierro, again, has a different character. I skipped it, and I went then from La Gomera to the last island, La Palma, which I couldn't hike because of the volcano eruption.
Right, right.
But again, very different, very lush forest there. It's very green. This is where bananas are planted. You walk through. I did parts of I hiked a little bit there. So I hiked through banana plantations, which is, again, something you wouldn't expect in the EU, but they have lots of banana plantations. So, and so each island has an incredibly different character, from completely black, barren lava to lush Lauri Silva Forest. It's amazing. in within 560 kilometers, as I said, this is the total length of the trail. If you hike all islands, you really go from desert-like to sort of lush jungle. It's amazing. And this, on such a small surface, is very, very unique. And this makes this trail really unique. Mm-hmm. Plus, last sentence to the sort of trail conditions. These islands are inhabited and cultivated for centuries. So where you're hiking on nowadays is really like old trails that used to connect one village with the other.
Okay.
So it's really century-old trails. And like when you sometimes when you approach these trails and you look from afar and like they seem to be glued to the to rocks, you think, no way whatever that you go there. This is not possible. But still, this is old, really like century-old engineering. And the trails are always like idiot-proof. So they are very well engineered, and because tourists are very valuable to the island authorities, they don't want anything to happen to the precious tourists. So right. The trails are incredibly well maintained, and even if they go up to high altitude or a steep or whatever, they are always well engineered. So this is, I can happily recommend this for beginners. Because the infrastructure is very, 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 very good and well, everything's well maintained.
Right. So almost an ideal destination if one wants to mix hiking and beaches.
Perfect, yeah. Perfect. And the best thing is like, because there's lots of like all-inclusive places or places where you pay for half or full pension, like when you can, like they serve you dinner and breakfast and it's cheaper. So... because the bus service is so good on all these islands. Again, this is they live mainly on of tourism. So everything's catering for tourists. So you could base yourself in a posh resort. And if you book far ahead or if you go off season, it can be relatively cheap. And then come and you can hike during the day and relax in the evening, relax next to the pool, have some margarita, sangria, God knows what, party, and next day you go hiking again. So it's ideal for that.
Well, sounds like a nice way to spend a vacation. So is it truly all year round that one could hike this? Is there, there, okay.
Yes.
I mean, I know I've lived in the tropics and there were seasons when you wouldn't do it because it's just too humid or too stormy, but that's not a problem in the Canaries.
No, it's so close to the equator that the seasons are barely noticeable, so you could really do it year round, and especially like the low islands like Lanzarote and Fuerteventura, the Teide might have problems in winter, but other than that, it's doable year round. The only problem is, again, like if you go in December or January, it will be full with European tourists. So right. Finding accommodation will be expensive.
So what did you say the situation was with camping?
Legally, it's forbidden.
Right.
You can do it. It's a bit of a problem on the volcanic island because it's all barren, windy, and right. Nothing to hide behind. The other islands, you've always find something. But I felt a bit guilty free camping there because like this is very, very touristy. So if everybody wild camps there, it will destroy nature. And there's lots of like day trippers and God knows what. So. Even I stayed in a lot of like paid accommodation because it felt environmentally friendlier. Plus, you always have the dam problem with the ferries. So in order to catch the ferry, you end up in paid accommodation almost all the time because otherwise you cannot catch the ferry. So logistics planning when do I want to be in which island and when which ferry to take, this is really difficult. Logistically, this is difficult. Otherwise, food, accommodation, water, no problem because you come across villages all the time. You can buy food, you can eat. This is very, very easy. It's a tourist island.
Considerations in terms of safety or security or...
Well, keep an eye open for volcano alerts.
Yes.
I mean, I hadn't expected like one of the biggest volcano eruptions in whole Europe happening just when I am there. But really, science is very advanced, is far advanced. So they know, they can predict when a volcano will erupt. So you will know before and you will be evacuated.
Right.
But just keep an eye on that.
But no wildlife to be concerned about that you were aware of.
Actually, there is some kind of wildlife which you really have to be concerned about. And this is, I think it's on Gran Canaria. Not quite, I think it's on Gran Canaria. Is some sort of squirrel. And this really? Squirrel was introduced back like last century only. And it's a nightmare for farmers because these sort of squirrels, they are called earth squirrels or something like that, they eat all the crop. But they don't only eat like the crop, they also eat like everything in your backpack. So you really, really have to secure your food or you might end up... I woke up and all my M&Ms were gone because it contained nuts, of course, and this is what the squirrels had eaten. So this is a bit of a problem.
It's like marmots at altitude.
Exactly. But they are smaller. They get in everywhere, these little squirrels.
Really? Huh. And so with both of these, both Crete and the Canaries, you've mentioned guidebooks that one can refer to. What were the ones in Crete that you mentioned?
Okay, in Crete, there is the guidebook is called The Cretan Way. So don't Google E4, which was my mistake when I was researching this guidebook. It's called The Cretan Way by an Italian guy who's living on Crete. He's called Luca Gianotti. It's in English. And for the for the Trekking Canary Islands, it's actually a Cicerone guidebook, an English guidebook.
Yep.
By Patty Dillon, and it's called Trekking in the Canary Islands, the GR131 Island Hopping Route. So this is those are available online.
Mm-hmm.
So and Patty, both are in English.
Patty Dillon is one of the most active of the Cicerone authors.
Exactly.
Yeah, I've hiked using his guides. Okay, great. I think that's a pretty good rundown on both of these hikes. What is the best way for listeners to find out more about your adventures, what you're doing? And I mean, you're a published author and you're about to publish another book. So go ahead and bring us up to date on that.
Okay. So I've already published 3 books, which all have become bestsellers in Germany. The first book will be published end of February. It will actually contain a chapter of each of these trails we just discussed.
Mm-hmm.
But it will be in German so far only. Let's see whether we've translated into English or not. We'll see, find out. But if you're interested in one of these trails, I'm posting regularly on Facebook and Instagram. I'm posting in German on Facebook, but on Instagram, I'm posting in English. And all these hikes, the E4 and the GR131, are actually still in my story highlights. So if you go to my Insta account, which is Christine_Turmer, and Turmer is spelled Thuermer, so Christine_Turmer, go to the story highlights and you will see all the pictures of these hikes and all that what happened to me there. You will also see this spectacular picture of me standing in front of red glowing lava.
Christine, thank you very much for joining us today. And I hope we'll talk to you again in the future about more trails that you experience.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to be your guest. Bye for now.
Thank you for listening to the Trails Around the World podcast. Please visit us online at trailsaroundtheworld.com and please join our Facebook group under the same name. If you liked this podcast, please help us out by leaving a review on your favorite podcast source. This is Sky King, and I look forward to you joining us next time. In the meantime, happy trails to you, and please remember to leave no trace as you enjoy the outdoors.